From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Taxation without representation, that is the slogan on many Washington, D.C. license plates. The district is home to about 600,000 people, but it does not have a representative who can vote in Congress. That could soon change. For more on the story, we have Theola LeBay-DeBose, a staff writer for The Washington Post. Hi, Theola.
Hey, Tony. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. This story is one that keeps coming back and back and back and back. Is there any reason to believe that we are closer now to getting an actual vote for voting representation for the district than we have been before?
Well, there is a lot of optimism right now among city leaders and supporters of this bill. First of all, we have more Democrats now in Congress. We also have a Democratic president. We obviously have the atmosphere of change in the country. It seems like now all of the stars might be aligning in terms of all of those factors coming to bear on this issue.
Now, in the Senate, as I understand it, there have been a number of amendments tacked on to the measure in an attempt to kill it. Is that correct?
Yes, and this is very typical. There can be a bill on dog licenses, and then let's say there's some kind of amendment on corn subsidies. I mean, this is sort of very typical, and it's on all of the hot button issues having to do with the district. There was an amendment about the gun laws in the city, something that the D.C. Council seriously opposes because they feel that they should have the right. The term is called home rule, to really set the rules for the district. And that's been this whole issue going back and forth. Everyone agrees that it is not a state. It is a federal district. However, for reasons of funding, education laws, all sorts of things, D.C. is treated like a state. And so there is the position of why don't they then have a vote in Congress?
Now, it's boiling down, is it not, Theola, to the issue of your interpretation of the United States Constitution, whether or not you have to be a state to have voting representation in Congress, or whether or not Congress has the power to do what it would like to do with the District of Columbia.
And that is at the heart of the issue, Tony. And those who oppose this say, well, if you read the Constitution very strictly, it says that all states have voting members of Congress. And then they say D.C. is not a state, so therefore to do this is unconstitutional.
Now, the measure would give, if it does pass, it would give a Democratic seat in Congress to represent the district. It would also give a second and a Republican seat to the state of Utah based on census figures. But that seat, the one going to Utah, could change depending upon future census reports.
Absolutely. Now, part of the reason why this latest attempt seems to be promising, according to people who support it, is that there is that compromise. It's not just give D.C. a seat. D.C. is heavily Democratic, and so folks on the other side of the aisle might cry foul. You say, okay, as usual in politics, if we give something to someone, then let's also give a little something to someone else. And so I think that the folks who are supporting this in Congress feel that it does seem somewhat fair to then say, okay, D.C. is so Democratic. I mean, there were people dancing in the streets for Obama after he won by, you know, practically 100%, but close to it. So therefore, if there's a way to have equal representation, then let's do that.
Final thing is, what has the administration said? Has it begun to actively involve itself one way or the other with regard to this issue?
Not yet. Obviously, the president has to wait on any issue to see how Congress kind of boils down and then to see whether they send him something to sign or not. But the non-voting delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, made it very clear right after the election that this was the first order of business that she would work on, and she has stuck to that promise.
All right, Theola, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
That was Theola LeBay DeBose, a staff writer for The Washington Post. She joined us from the studios of The Washington Post. We're now going to hear from some Washington, D.C. residents who have some very distinct opinions on the matter. We have Eugene DeWitt Kinlow, Public Affairs Director for D.C. Vote, and Mark Lerner, a Washington, D.C.-based libertarian blogger. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Hello.
Eugene, let's begin with you. Voting rights in Washington, that's been a longstanding issue going back, as we said, many, many years when the 23rd Amendment was passed, giving them the right to vote in presidential elections. The issue, though, now, as I discussed with Theola just a moment ago, is the constitutionality of giving D.C. citizens a voting representative in Congress. But the Constitution isn't really clear on this, is it?
Well, let me just say that there are two areas in the Constitution that proponents and opponents take guidance from. The Constitution speaks about the relationship between the House of Representatives, and the people, and says that the House of Representatives shall be comprised of citizens from the several states. Well, Washington, D.C. is a District of Columbia, and in fact, when the Constitution was written, the District of Columbia had not been created yet. Proponents of D.C. voting rights look toward guidance to another section of the Constitution, which speaks to the power that Congress has, the exclusive plenary powers it has in jurisdiction over the District of Columbia. We believe that Congress can provide a vote with simple legislation.
Now, Eugene, I know that you have a different point of view, and I'd like to hear it, but I also want to ask you this question, because either way, it is expected that this matter could go all the way to the United States Supreme Court. But in the meantime, the battle on Capitol Hill is over. In addition to the issue of your interpretation of the Constitution, some very controversial amendments that are being offered as a way to scuttle the bill, one of them having to do with the district's strict gun control laws. My question is this a legitimate way to handle such an important matter?
Well, we believe, and many citizens and our elected officials believe, that our elected officials should make rules and regulations and laws for our people, that Congress should not come in and make rules exclusively for the District of Columbia and not other states. We don't see Congress trying to enact strong or different gun laws for the rest of the country. No, they're doing it here because they realize that we don't have a vote in Congress, and we don't have any political weight. So they're using this as a test case. I believe that there will be enough votes to succeed in passing this in the House and in the Senate. And you're right. Currently, Senator Ensign is pushing an amendment that will open up gun access and delete gun restrictions that are already on the books for the District of Columbia. We believe that we'll be successful. Now, to talk about a point that you mentioned with Theola earlier, actually, we will have the support of President Obama. He was a co-sponsor of the legislation last year and has indicated if the bill gets to him, he will sign it.
Eugene, I went to you by mistake. I was trying to raise that question for Mark. I apologize. Mark, let me repeat it for you just in case I wasn't clear.
Sure.
I'd like to know whether or not you think that this is a legitimate way to oppose the measure, and speak briefly to what your opposition is based around.
Sure. Let me start by saying I am a 30-year Washington, D.C. resident. I am very interested in having representation in both houses of Congress. I have on my car the license plate that says no taxation without representation. So this issue is very dear to me. On the other side, though, I don't think we should be playing around with the U.S. Constitution. And to disagree with what Eugene said earlier, the Constitution is very clear on this matter. Article 1, Section 2 says the House of Representatives shall be elected by people of the several states, and D.C. is not a state. And it's not just me that says this. I'm, of course, not a constitutional lawyer, but Ela Shapiro from the Cato Institute has written a column that says the exact same thing, that this is an unconstitutional move and should not be approved. In reference to your question as to whether amendments could be offered, I think that's just the way Congress operates, that standard operating procedure in Congress. I think I will agree for a second with Eugene that this will pass both houses of Congress. I think it'll be signed by the president, and I'm totally confident that the Supreme Court will overrule it.
Now, are you of the opinion that even with the attempt to offer bipartisan balance by putting a congressional seat in the state of Utah, a Republican one, that that's not sufficient?
No, I think that's a scheme. And I don't think we should be playing games with the U.S. Constitution. It's a very solemn document. It's very clear. Just let me talk about the district clause for a second, because I think any reasonable person would come to the conclusion that the district clause does not allow Congress to just approve representatives for the district, because if that were true, they could decide the district would have 6 representatives to the House and 5 to the Senate. It makes absolutely no sense.
So there's disagreement. You both agree on the interpretation of the Constitution. Mark, you would be what we would call a strict constructionist of the Constitution in this regard?
That's correct.
And in your case, Eugene, you think that the Constitution allows for a broader interpretation, which would give Congress the power to, in fact, provide voting rights to the citizens of the district.
And that's correct. And what happens is Mark pointed on one point, touched on one part of the Constitution, and I talked about another part
about
of the
another
Constitution.
Part. All right.
So how does that get resolved? It gets resolved through the courts. The bill provides for an expedited judicial review so that it will be met in the courts, and they'll decide this question if there is a challenge.
Well, it certainly has been a question that has been ongoing for many, many, many years, and hopefully a resolution will be reached this time around. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Eugene DeWitt Kinlow is the Public Affairs Director for D.C. Vote. Mark Lerner is a Washington, D.C.-based libertarian blogger. They both joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. On Tuesday, as part of his wide-ranging speech to a joint session of Congress, President Obama put forward his vision for health care reform in the United States, but not before he outlined the true cost to Americans under the current system.
In the last 8 years, premiums have grown 4 times faster than wages. And in each of these years, 1 million more Americans have lost their health insurance. It is one of the major reasons why small businesses close their doors and corporations ship jobs overseas. And it is one of the largest and fastest growing parts of our budget. Given these facts, we can no longer afford to put health care reform on hold.
In a few moments, we'll discuss President Obama's health policy ideas. But first, just what does it mean to be one of the thousands of Americans living without health insurance? Joining me now is Jesse Alexander. He was laid off from his job just over a year ago and now pays $1,300 every month for health insurance for himself and for his wife. Jesse, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, you were laid off a year ago, as we said, and as a result, you now have health coverage under COBRA, which offers you the chance to continue the same health coverage that you received under your employer, but you pay out of your own pocket. How has this worked out for you?
Well, it's not working out very well. It's quite expensive. I just have to correct the figure there. It's actually $1,140. It's pretty onerous. It's difficult.
How does it impact your household finances otherwise?
Well, it's just about $600 shy of $600 or $700 shy of our mortgage. So it's pretty rough. Our finances are basically paying the mortgage and the health insurance.
Did you ever consider going without it, the risk of going without insurance because of the cost?
We did, but for us, it's really not an option. We are on maintenance medication because of what the industry calls pre-existing conditions. So we just really don't have that alternative. It has to be either through COBRA or through some other private insurance.
Now, even though you're covered, what would happen financially to you if you had a medical emergency?
I really don't want to think about it. It would really be rough. We would probably be in danger of losing our house.
Now, you've heard, I'm assuming, the president talk about health care reform. What does it mean to you when you hear the possibility of reform, and what particularly would you like to see that would help benefit you and your wife?
What I would like to see, it means a lot that health care is front and center, and I'm glad that the president is talking about it. But I must say that We need, in my view, to restructure the entire program. I think we need to be talking about universal health care and in the form of single payer, because as long as the insurance companies are in the absolute center of this thing, I don't think this situation is going to change much.
My final question is this: what happens to you when your COBRA runs out?
Well, Maryland has a program called MHIP, Maryland Health Insurance Program, and we will automatically qualify for that. The coverage will be considerably reduced, but at least we'll have coverage for the prescriptions for the maintenance medication. So that's going to be our final sort of our place of last resort. We're also exploring options like bartering with our doctor and maybe paying in cash for some services, and seeing if we can't leverage alternative care in some way that would keep costs down.
Jesse, thank you very much, and good luck to you and your wife.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the time.
That was Jesse Alexander. He was laid off last year and now pays just over $1,100 a month for COBRA health coverage for himself and for his wife. That monthly premium is just between $600 and $700 less than his mortgage payment. So with more and more people finding themselves in the same position as Jesse, just how will President Obama's health care plans help them? Here's how he outlined some of his health care agenda during his address to a joint session of Congress on Tuesday.
Our recovery plan will invest in electronic health records and new technology that will reduce errors, bring down costs, ensure privacy, and save lives. It will launch a new effort to conquer a disease that has touched the life of nearly every American, including me, by seeking a cure for cancer in our time.
Of course, there are varying thoughts on President Obama's plans and his policies. Let's turn now to Robert Moffitt, director of the Center for Health Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, a public policy research institute, and Linda Bloomberg. She is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute's Health Policy Center. Linda, Robert, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How are you?
Linda, let's start with you. We just heard from Jesse Alexander, one of thousands of Americans struggling with health care costs. You've analyzed the president's health care plans so far. What are some of the key reforms being proposed that would help Jesse?
Well, there's a number of the reforms that are being proposed that will directly assist him and his family. First of all, under the Obama plan, there would be a new national health insurance exchange, which would be set up to contract with private insurance plans, and that would also likely have a competing public insurance plan for individuals to purchase coverage from. And those plans would be available at a subsidized cost so that individuals who were low income or who had lost jobs, even temporarily, could get financial assistance to make sure coverage is affordable to them. And those plans that would be available through the exchange and in the market in general would no longer be able to exclude pre-existing conditions, something that the other person talked about being a problem for him and his family, and the plans would not be allowed to rate insurance coverage based upon the health status of the individuals enrolling. So they would take the health care risks of all the people and spread them much more broadly than we see in the insurance market today.
Now, Robert, the plan that the president is proposing carries a $634 billion price tag for a reserve fund to be put in place over the next decade, a fund that could balloon to as much as $1 trillion. And the president also has spoken in fairly broad terms about how he would like to tackle health care reform. What do you make of his vision? Is it feasible in your estimation?
Well, yes, it's feasible. I mean, we've bailed out banks. We've just passed a $1 trillion stimulus package. His estimated projected reform, as you point out, is $634 billion. Most experts think it's going to be $1 trillion. Over the 10-year period. I got to tell you, though, Tony, government officials rarely get it right when it comes to the true cost of government health policy proposals, especially with Medicare and Medicaid, and certainly this new one. Invariably, it usually costs a lot more than they tell you that it is going to cost. That's the historical record. So we're looking at an expensive proposal here. The president says that he wants to save the typical family $2,500 annually in health insurance premiums. I think that is unlikely. I think it is more likely that the overall cost of this will result in higher taxes across the board, not just taxes on the rich.
Now, in a paper that you wrote, Robert, in December called How a Public Health Plan Will Erode Private Care, you say that, quote, the vast majority of American voters oppose any kind of government-controlled health plan if it means that they have to change their own health insurance coverage. But what about the people who just can't afford or don't have health insurance, or people like Jesse Alexander who are just barely hanging on?
I'm very familiar with Jesse's case. He's from Maryland. I was on the Maryland Health Care Commission. I'm very familiar with the health insurance market in Maryland, and I can tell you I sympathize deeply with him because, frankly, the government policy in Maryland has made it very difficult for people like Jesse to get affordable health insurance. In the state of Maryland, there are 62 benefit mandates on individual health insurance, so you have to buy all kinds of benefits, whether you want them or not, just benefits, not just benefits to protect you and your family against the normal health care costs that we run into. The other point is, too, and one of the most disappointing facts about the Obama's proposal is that while he wants to tax the rich to pay for this, he leaves the most regressive feature of the federal tax code, which is basically unlimited tax breaks for people, regardless of where they work or regardless of their income, in place in the current system. Well, this undercuts affordability for millions of Americans. A person like Jesse can get unlimited tax breaks if they get health insurance through the place of work. But if he has to buy individual insurance, he has to pay for it with after-tax dollars that can add as much as 30 to 40 or even 50% to the cost of the premium. So if we would provide direct and immediate tax relief to people like Jesse so they can get the health insurance that they want, they would be a lot better off. Certainly they'd be a lot better off than being stuck in a program like Medicaid or some other government program where you get what the government gives you.
What about that, Linda? How complicated and complex is the issue of trying to enact health care reform when issues such as the health insurance companies as well as the tax structure play such a vital role?
Well, whatever we do to create a more comprehensive system of health insurance coverage is going to be complex. We've got an incredibly complex base that we're starting from. And so all of the problems that we see in the market, to redress them is no simple task because we've really created what I consider pretty much of a mess in terms of the patchwork pieces here. So things that are going to address all of the problems we have are going to feel complex. But we do have a good deal of experience looking at what we can do now. And I think there's a growing consensus around the types of approaches that the Obama plan is suggesting that we take.
For example, over what areas?
That we cannot have a system of insurance coverage that discriminates by health status and excludes those that or hampers their ability to get reasonable coverage as a consequence of their past health status. We need to have a system in place where insurance coverage is available to everyone regardless of their health status, that we're not discriminating the way we do in private markets. To just give people a subsidy to use as individuals in the current non-group market in the vast majority of states does not help all of the people who, like Jesse and his family members, who have past health conditions and who would likely be excluded from those markets as a consequence of them. So what we need is a purchasing pool type system where we've got insurance market reforms that open up the system to all of those regardless of health care risk, that provide subsidies in order to make coverage affordable, and that spreads the health care risk of the sick very broadly across the population order to ensure consistent, comprehensive coverage over time.
Let me direct this question to the both of you, Robert and Linda. The role of the private insurance carrier. What responsibility do they bear, in your view, for the predicament that we are in? What responsibilities do they have in terms of trying to get us out of that? And I'm reminding you both of what Jesse said, that he thought that the restructuring should involve some sort of universal health care single-payer program. Robert?
Well, I'll go first. I think that the private insurance companies are responding to the incentives that are given them. The fact is that health insurance is one of the most highly regulated sectors of the American economy. It is regulated in such a way where the government, in effect, picks winners and losers. Jesse is a loser because of government policy, not because of the health insurance company. The issue of what kind of rules we ought to have for health insurance, that is a key point. I think Linda's absolutely right. There should not be a discrimination of people simply on the basis of their health, and there should be a spreading of risk. I was involved in efforts with Governor Romney to create a new type of insurance market where we would spread risk more equitably in Massachusetts, and the result of that has been that people have a greater access to health insurance. But it's not the health insurance executives. It's the environment in which they work. And the environment in which they work has been created directly by Congress, which has an unfair and inequitable tax treatment of health insurance, and state legislators who, in many cases, enact laws and rules and regulations which have unintended consequences that drive health care costs up and make it less affordable for millions of Americans.
So Linda Roberts says it's not the fault of the private insurance carriers, it is the fault of the government. What do you say?
In general, I agree with that statement, but I would put a different spin on it because, yes, when you put regulations in place or rules in place for insurers to follow, they are businesses and they will maximize profit as within the constraints of the rules that have been set out. And it is our responsibility to be thinking about those rules. And part of what makes this situation very difficult and makes the insurers, I think, look like the villains in this is that we have a system that is a voluntary system. And so individuals can move in and out at will, and the insurers are protecting themselves against worrying that people are going to come in only when they need to use a lot of medical services by price discriminating against those who are sick. And so with this system, we actually have a very unregulated non-group health insurance market in most states in the country. And so what we see is, especially for those who are outside the employer context, we've got a situation where the rules have been set up to really harm those who are those most in need and most vulnerable. And so on top of that, we don't have a system that is going to make coverage affordable for those who are the lowest income in the country. So we've got to change the rules so that we can make sure that everybody is in the market. We don't have this adverse selection issue of people moving in and out, that can then do proper broad risk spreading that we both agree ought to take place.
All right, here's the final question that I have, and it's going to have to be a yes or no answer from the both of you. Millions of people are facing unemployment, and they can pay for COBRA to extend their health benefits, usually very expensive, as we know. But as part of the stimulus package that was just signed, the government is now going to subsidize payments by 65%. The question, yes or no, should the government be using taxpayer funds in this way? Robert?
No.
Linda?
I don't have a problem with what they're doing. You know, you want a yes or no. I'll say yes, it's fine, but it doesn't go far enough.
All
because
right.
A lot are left out.
Our time is out. Thank you.
That's
very much.
View.
Robert Moffitt, Director of the Center for Health Policy Studies. Linda Bloomberg, Senior Fellow at the Urban Institute's Health Policy Center. Thank you again. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Thursday is the day for our look at the world of sports, and coming out of limbo is the theme of this week's segment. Charles Barkley's back on the mic. Stephon Marbury returns to the back court. Barry Bonds is back in court. Tiger Woods back on the course. Here to help me make sense of all this is Kevin Figures, who blogs about sports at AM570Radio.com, and Chad Brown, who blogs at AlphaBlogSports.com. Hey, guys.
How's it going, Tony?
It's great.
What's up, Tony?
Nice to see you. Let's talk about Tiger. Big news of the week. Tiger ready to roar once again. His first appearance since last summer and knee surgery coming yesterday in Arizona, where he looked like, well, the Tiger of old, didn't he? Without Tiger, nobody was watching golf, and now they are again, right, Kev?
Oh, definitely. Tiger is the breadwinner when it comes to golf. I think it was Stuart Sink who said it the other day that when he came out to tee off, there was only about five people in the stands because everybody was following Tiger. Everybody wanted to see Tiger Woods. He's definitely the biggest draw for that sport.
You know what, Kat? I wonder this. Is it good or bad when one athlete is so dominant that his presence alone can dictate a sport's popularity?
It all depends on whether he's active or not. I think in Tiger's case, it definitely is. It's definitely a good thing because he's such a big brand, even though he's been in the news mostly for non-golf related stuff like his appearance at the inauguration festivities and the birth of his son. But I made the mistake when I was on here last year of saying that I didn't think the sport would be affected. It wouldn't go in the toilet without him, and it clearly it did.
Did you say that?
I did say that. I said it. I was wrong, but
we give you a pass on it. We know you didn't know
better. I'm just glad to have him back. Right. It was just great seeing him out there in the blue shirt pumping the fist. And if this is him rusty, well, I don't want the field does not want to see what it's going to look
when
he's healthy.
Are they trembling in their boots? They have to be. Speaking of what's good or bad in golf, here's a big story circulating on the links this week. Northern Trust Corporation got a verbal beatdown from members of Congress for hosting a lavish golf tournament, the Northern Trust Golf Championship at the Riviera Country Club right here in L.A. last week. Now, there were reports, guys, of expenses at luxury hotels, flying company employees out here, lavish dinners, big-name entertainment like Sheryl Crow, and trinkets from Tiffany's, no less, for the guests. And did I mention that Northern Trust received $1.6 billion from the government as part of their bank bailout? The company says, we didn't do anything wrong, but some members of Congress want some of our money back, Kev. What about that?
I think Congress deserves his money back. In our economic times we're having now, for them to go out and basically spend this on having a tournament and having all these extra, you said, things from Tiffany's and things of that nature. I think Congress feels that their money should be more well spent than on making the rich. I don't want to say make the rich richer, but you know what I mean, to help these extra expenditures for things that really aren't very important.
Well, you know, I've been to Riviera. I'm sure you probably have too. I mean, that's like nice of the nice, right?
It is.
Can't you, Chad, put on a golf tournament without all the bells and whistles?
Yeah, yes, you can. And I think in a lot of cases we're seeing some tournaments that they can't provide the bells and whistles. I think in a couple of cases they're canceling. But I've been to plenty of golf tournaments where it's not frills free, but it can be done. It can be done. And I think I pretty much agree with Kevin. This is kind of an air of, whether it's fiscal or not, just an air of irresponsibility on the part of these people. They can, now it's a free country, they can do what they want, but in the face of these tough economic times, it just does not make much sense.
Well, they cannot do what they want with the money provided for them by Congress. They can only do what Congress is going to allow them to do with part of that money. You don't have to have Dixie cups. Okay, but you don't have to have Tiffany's either, right?
Absolutely.
Something in between.
Exactly.
All right, basketball, gentlemen, in the headlines this week, from college to the pros, but it is an old pro who has dominated a lot of the discussion lately, Sir Charles Barkley, who returned to the TNT airwaves after his alcohol-induced sabbatical. Now he's looking at 5 days in the Hooskow for his run-in with police, set to start next month sometime. He's apologized, Kevin, and life goes on, of course, but does the punishment fit the crime, or did he get off a little easy because, after all, he is Sir Charles and he is really entertaining?
I don't know if I'd say he got off easy because there have been a lot of cases of other athletes, current athletes, who've actually gotten off. I mean, Leonard Little from the St. Louis Rams got away with murder. Mm-hmm. I don't think he did any time. Charles Barkley is going to do 5 days in jail. He actually came out. He apologized. He took responsibility. It doesn't make right what he did. He could have killed somebody or himself. But at the same time, I think this is, 5 days in jail for Charles Barkley, who show remorse. He's gonna be back. He's gonna be fine. So I think the punishment is actually more so than it has been in the past for current athletes.
Really, I'm certainly not trying to throw Sir Charles under the bus, but the question just is whether or not he's so popular on TNT and they need him so badly to get back in the booth. Is that a consideration at all, Chad? Do you think, in terms of how he was treated in the criminal justice system in Arizona?
Well, no, I think that he's got that. I agree with Kevin. I think this is appropriate. I mean, from everything I've heard, this isn't going to be country club. He's going to have to wear pink, what they call pink long johns, I believe.
And oh, yeah, that's right. They do that in Arizona.
While he's on work release, if he messes up just once, then that's revoked. But I think in Charles's case, I think it's very refreshing to hear somebody say, hey, you know what? I messed up. This is not good, instead of saying, well, I apologize if I offended anybody.
Well, if you drive to spring training, you're likely to see Charles out on the Interstate 10 in one of those pink pants picking up trash on the side of the freeway for those 10 days.
Well, he did the crime. He's going to have to do the time.
Absolutely. Stephon Marbury, speaking speaking of troubled star, sports star, Stephon has been bought out by the New York Knicks and is said to be ready to sign with the Boston Celtics any day now. Boston star Paul Pierce saying of Marbury, Chad, he's high risk, high reward. But with the Celtics trying to repeat and at the moment looking up both at Cleveland and at Los Angeles, and they got thumped by the Clippers last night of all people, it seems that they're willing to do something. The question is this the thing to do?
Well, I think if he's available, and bear in mind he does have some history with KG, I think I wouldn't say it's a win-win situation for Boston, but clearly they need help. If he understands his role, it should be okay if he understands that this stuff is not going to fly, because the Celtics have done a great job of, you know, restoring the pride to the uniform. And if he understands that what he did in New York is not going to fly, then it'll be okay. And if he doesn't, they have him for now, and then they'll get rid of him later. I think it could go either way. I don't think it's going to implode. But
the other question, though, I guess, Kevin, is how he will impact them on the floor, because when he comes, if he comes, he's going to take time away from Rajon Rondo and as well as from Eddie House, who comes off the bench and fires up those threes pretty regularly. If he comes onto the floor, they've got to sit down. One of them's got to sit down.
Well, definitely. I think they both know what's happening. We saw the end of the Clipper game last night with Rajon Rondo at the end of the game. It shows exactly what an experienced point guard can do for you if you have him out there. Stephon Marbury is going to take time coming in, gelling with the guys, have a few practices. It wouldn't shock me that if in the first week or so he didn't even play, he maybe didn't even dress. Mm-hmm. He comes in, he practices a little bit, he gets some familiarity with the guys, and he brings that veteran presence off the bench. Like was said earlier, it's a low-risk move. If he comes in and he doesn't gel, they're not going to pay him that much. You can just let him go.
Well, it will be interesting to see whether it works out. I think he's going to sign with him, don't you?
Definitely. I think he's definitely going to sign. I think everything's been said. Doc Rivers, I believe, said that he believes it's going to happen. So I think it's just a matter of time now.
I think you're absolutely right, and I agree with you again about Rajon Rondo's play at the end of the game last night. I think if there was ever a question about getting another guard in to help out, that play sort of sealed that deal.
Very ironic.
Let's talk about college hoops for a moment, gentlemen. We're approaching tournament time and March Madness. It seems all the powers are in the East this year. Connecticut, Pitt, North Carolina, Duke. One of these four, I think. I want to know what you think, Kevin. One of these four is likely to be the national champion.
Definitely. I said North Carolina before the season started. Pittsburgh's really impressed me, even though they lost to Providence the other night. They're really playing well out there in the Big East, and I think that they can definitely pose a challenge to North Carolina for a run this year. Nobody's really been dominant this season. There's a lot of good teams in the ACC with Wake Forest and North Carolina and Duke, and some teams have come up like Clemson and Florida State that people didn't expect to be this good. So I think it's going to be an interesting tournament. I don't think anybody that you can say is a lock to win the championship this year.
I agree with you. Why is the East so good, so strong, so dominant this year, Chad Brown?
Well, I think it just goes in cycles. I mean, UConn has been a perennial power. You've got North Carolina, Duke, if nothing for the name, nothing else. And you've got – and I think you also see that these teams are not invulnerable. I mean, you can see UNC getting upset by Maryland and then Duke going down there and beating Maryland themselves. And Pitt, like you say, they're number one, but they're not invincible. So no team is invincible, but they've all got strengths. I think it's going to be an exciting tournament. I just have no idea what's going to happen.
You know, and I forgot to mention Oklahoma, didn't I?
Oklahoma, Blake Griffin. Still out with the concussion, I believe, but he'll be back. And they're another perennial power
they're
out
tough.
There, so we'll see what's
absolutely.
Don't mess with the Sooners.
All right, guys. Baseball, Major League Baseball spring training is in full effect right now in Arizona and in Florida. But the headline, at least here in L.A., is the latest offer. I think this is offer number four, if I'm keeping track, from the Dodgers to Mr. Manny Ramirez, number 99, Manny being Manny. I don't think I've ever seen a team, Kev, want a player so badly but be unable to work out a smooth deal. And Manny is out there with nobody picking him up. He's just sitting around. Somebody's got to blink, and I'm beginning to think it's going to be Manny Ramirez.
Absolutely. It's like it's a situation of who's going to, you know, who's going to cave in first, the Dodgers or Manny. It's like they both want to be with one another, but nobody's willing to concede to the other's offer. The Dodgers don't feel that there's anybody else out there willing to pay Manny Ramirez what they want to offer. And Manny, I don't know what he's doing, why it's the negotiations are taking so long. I believe the latest offer is 2 years, $45 million, except with the difference being from the first offer, this gives him a player option for the second year as opposed to a team option.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, it's basically been a merry-go-round for the last couple of months, and I don't know when the end's going to come. It has to come pretty soon with spring training already in gear here. So,
could you imagine, Chad Brown, what the conversation is like between Manny and his agent, Scott Boras, with $45 million on the table, nobody else calling, not even the San Francisco Giants, apparently, spring training underway, and he's just sitting around?
Well, I mean, this is Manny being Manny. I can't say I'm, from having watched him afar up in Boston, I can't say I'm totally surprised by all of this, but I think Manny will eventually sign. I mean, capitals or italics or quotations on eventually, whatever you want to put. But this doesn't necessarily surprise me, but it seems like it's going to happen. Just a question of when and for how much and who's going to have the advantage, the club or him, in terms of the buyout clause.
All right, it's off season for the NFL, but that doesn't mean they don't make headlines. This week, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell giving up 20% of his salary, the league slashing 15% of its workforce in a nod to the economic downturn. That sounds good, but is this PR? Or is it real?
I believe it's real. I mean, I think they have to, especially with all the money that's tied up into the National Football League and all of these leagues. You know, I don't think Roger Goodell is doing this for our PR. So I think it's legitimate. He's trying to help out the economy of the NFL. There was a story earlier this week about the NBA taking out a loan to have to pay back all these different teams that are coming out in the red. And I think the NFL doesn't want to have to do that. So they're doing what they find necessary to give themselves more flexibility monetarily throughout their season for the rest of the teams for their league.
And it comes, if I heard this, I don't know if it's correct or not, Chad Brown, that while Goodell is taking a cut in pay, his counterpart in the Major League Baseball, Bud Selig, is taking a raise. Is that right?
I would have to check on that to confirm, but it doesn't surprise me about Roger. Roger Goodell, whatever you want to say about him, has really proved to be for the most part, be a stand-up guy. So if he's saying that he's going to take a pay cut, I don't think it's PR at all. I think it's genuine. As far as Bud goes, I stopped trying to predict, to understand what Bud does a long time ago. So,
okay, we covered a lot of ground today. We got about a minute left, so we might as well throw one more topic in there really quickly. The NFL Combine ended in Indianapolis. Anybody stand out for you, Kev?
Nobody particularly stood out. I know a couple of guys weren't as impressive as people thought. Aaron Curry had some mixed reviews. Ray Maluga from USC, I think, pulled a hamstring during his 40 time, so he might have to run again in his pro day. Michael Crabtree from Texas Tech was injured and didn't participate. So those are some interesting tidbits. It'll be interesting to see what Michael Crabtree does, because he has to have surgery, and people don't know if he's going to participate at pro day or not.
Really, really quickly, Chad Brown, Mark Sanchez from USC, whose coach told him not to go, has done pretty well in the combine so far, hasn't he?
No, he's definitely done a great job. This is a down year for quarterbacks, so anybody putting up even a mildly good show is going to get theirs. I think he'll be fine. I think he'll be fine.
All right, guys, man, you earned your money today. If we were paying you, which we're not, so thank you very much.
Downturn, we understand.
This is a downtime for everybody. Kevin Figures blogs about sports at AM570Radio.com. He joined us here in the studios of NPR West, and Chad Brown blogs at Alpha Blog Sports. He joined us from our NPR studios in New York City. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Tony. How's it going?
I'm doing well, thank you. It sounds like a discussion about a cartoon, which many saw as racist, was the big letters topic this week.
That's right. A reporters' roundtable discussion last week about the controversial drawing in the New York Post showing two police officers shooting a chimpanzee sparked these comments. Molly Mead wrote, "I was offended by this cartoon, but for much more than racism. I live in Connecticut, where this awful tragedy occurred. No one seems to remember that a woman was critically injured. She will never be the same, no matter how many surgeries she has. Nothing about this entire situation is funny. It's an insult to the woman injured to portray it in a cartoon in this way."
And Robert Grijalva chimed in with this. "How is this cartoon racist? A chimp was shot by police for attacking a woman, right? I don't see the racism in this cartoon. Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid wrote the stimulus bill, not Obama. So where's the racism? Post, don't apologize. You don't need to."
And Keith Reuter in Oak Hill, Virginia, agreed with that sentiment. He wrote, "The suggested comparisons to Obama are so overblown. There's a website called www.bushorchimp.com which compares President G.W. Bush to a chimp. The website has been active since the year 2000 and has had over 5 million hits. The legs of the chimp Obama story demonstrates how liberal the press is.
Alan McDonald wrote after he heard a discussion about the possible nationalization of some struggling banks. He suggested this. It should be called democratization of the banks, not nationalization. The bottom line is that the banking system is now an unchallenged, unelected, and ruthless empire, and it must be brought into the service of, quote, the people under the control of our indivisible democracy.
And Gautam Chaudhary commented on a segment we did this week on a foundation started by the family of a schizophrenic musician, Nathaniel Anthony Ayers. Actor Jamie Foxx will play Ayers in an upcoming movie. He posted on our website. Look forward to seeing the movie. I love the idea of the foundation. Good luck and blessings to Nathaniel and all those that see music with all of their senses.
And finally, we did get several letters about our show's cancellation next month. Here's one from Faye Morgan in Anchorage, Alaska. I first started listening to your podcast on my iPod almost 2 years ago. I really enjoy your show. It is so informative and interesting to hear the different views. I'm sad you won't be around. I learned a lot from this show.
And that's it for letters. Please keep your thoughts coming over the next few weeks.
And to write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Glad you could join us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, with a first family who frequents museums and theaters, the arts community is hoping for a boost in support. But in such a faltering economy, just how much attention can the administration give to the fine arts?